Let's do it.
Let's do it. Welcome back to the Fitness in Philosophy podcast. My name is Robbie Gustin, and I'm joined. That is a meme now that Brandon just made 30 seconds ago. I'm joined, as always, by OPEX Fitness founder, James Fitzgerald. How are things going, James?
Good. I'll be honest. First thing I thought about was choke collars.
The mind goes where the mind goes.
You know there, that's the meme. You know, well, I'm being vulnerable here. I'm opening up what really comes on my mind. Like, that's the first thing. I'm owned by James. So I was thinking, oh, maybe my dog, you know, because my dog was choking last night. She wanted to sniff just too many times. And she does this, like, you know, no, but she has this, you know, choke collar on. And she's like, as if to say to me, you're going to kill me, you know? So anyways, I think that's where the choke collar thing came from when you said ownership.
Either that or, you know, the internet memes where, like, you know, Jordan Peterson disdominates or owns this, for, you know what I mean? Like, we can do a little clip. James Fitzgerald owns Robbie Gustin. Like,
destroyed. Destroyed. Man, the morality argument.
Man, you know, like it happened.
That's how you should change your, that's how you should change the fitness and philosophy clicks that people get on with that little story, right? The opening should be, James and Robbie destroy morality.
Yeah.
Maybe get more interest.
Yeah. 1 million views. Yeah. There we go.
They destroy pleasure and pain. They got nothing against us.
No, that's what people want.
So your original question was, what am I up to or what am I doing or what's...
No, actually I had a different question for you this week, but then I was looking back at the calendar and I thought it would just be kind of cool to reflect if you're up for it.
Yeah.
We actually, so as people probably know about podcasts, like, we're not recording this live on, you know, March 5th, and then it gets, you know, it's a few weeks to potentially a couple months later. We actually recorded our very first podcast in this vicinity of like a couple weeks last year.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah. So I don't know if you had any thoughts or reflections on kind of the past year. I just noticed that myself and was just kind of ruminating, but yeah. Just,
you know. No, gosh, what a year.
Yeah. What a year, right? In so many different ways. Maybe the biggest reflection is like, we've been doing these consistently pretty much every 2 weeks.
Well, I just finished Frank Wilczek's book called Fundamentals. You know, big brain thinker on physics. And one of the things that he said in there that I had in conversation yesterday with another individual, and that rings true to your question or to your point of like, do you have any thoughts on, you know, this time last year, this year, is just time, you know, goes on. It's a constant, and it just happens, you know, like now, you know, in a couple of seconds coming up here, I can talk about it, but there's going to be, you know, time changing on the clock, you know, there's movement and there's, you know, let's call it expansion. And growth. And that's what I reflect on when you're like, so what's your thoughts on a year? I was like, a year is time, like a lot went into that. And that makes me reflect on, how cool it is, you know, for the experiences that we can put together in our life for the time that we're here. That's what I immediately think about. How precious time is a cliche statement, right?
Yeah, but it's true. And I mean, just the fact that, like, I mean, now that I'm thinking back,
well, it is true, it's a truth.
Oh yeah. <Time. definitely. laughs> But just even the nature of, yeah, I mean, I wrote my dissertation on Kant's thoughts on time, and just,
oh, like, cool.
Yeah, so it's a very, very interesting topic.
Yeah.
But yeah, just even thinking back to, like, I think technically last year we were going to do the first episode on like this corresponding Friday And March 10th was when like everything really like hit. And I think you guys were in San Diego, I want to say, and like things got canceled or something. And had to drive back. And then like, I think
we drove back on the Friday. Wednesday night was when the, during the halftime of the NBA game that was on TV.
Yeah.
People, you know, the announcement was the NBA is ending its season. And it was, we all gathered our two families in the room and it was like, this shit is real now, you know? And I'm going to continue with this funny story. And we'll of course I was driving Friday, so we couldn't do it, by the way, but cause we decided not to get on a plane. These are the decisions you make at that time, right? I was like, no, we're not getting on a plane. We're going to stay in a little car ourselves as if we're, and I had these feelings of like the classic prepper, you know, get out of the apocalypse, leave LA, driving across the desert. These are the things I was thinking about. Look at me. I'm even like mimicking the wheel, you know, as I'm doing, looking around for zombies, right? Anyways, the COVID zombies. But I thought about what that means at that point in time when someone says, so you think you have a concept of what, you know, this comfort level of what's real and what's going on. And then when you hear those big statements like that, like, you know, the season is ending, I can just remember looking at everyone in the room and feeling this real deep awareness come over everyone. Like you're forced to, right? Yeah, everyone is forced to step up their game on awareness, right? And immediately everyone in the room, which what I noticed carefully, we all quickly got to what really mattered. Like you really started to sink in on what really mattered at that point in time. I'm just sharing that to go back to this point in time, you know, and say, well, what the hell was your brain going through on that Friday? You know, it was like driving across the desert, shaking off COVID zombies. That was going on in my head, basically.
No, that totally makes sense. Like I remember at the gym and just with, you know, some of my friends, it was like, so is this as big, you know, what's going to happen? Is this really a thing? You know, is this like the meme of the dog, like sitting around a, you know, a building that's like a blaze and this is fine. And then March 10th, because that's my sister's birthday. That was like the day. It was like the NBA, but it was also, I think, United Airlines called. There were a few different things that like all hit, and I was like, okay,
yeah,
this is happening.
This is definitely happening.
And then 2 days later, we had our first episode. Like wow. we didn't postpone it. We didn't, you know, we're like, hey, let's give this a shot.
Yeah.
And here we are a year later. So it's kind of cool.
It is. That's a great reflection. Thank you for that. And so today, what is today's episode, Robbie? Do you know the number?
I was just checking back before we started. I'm 90%+ sure it is episode 23, which, you know, if you give allowances for, I think there have been weeks off here and there, and there are 52 weeks in a year and 26 2-week blocks. That's pretty much roughly what a year of every 2 weeks would be.
Yep. And it's also the number of the greatest basketball player of all time.
LeBron James. No, I'm just kidding.
No, that's so disappointing.
I completely so disappointing. Disagree with that. I'm a huge Michael Jordan fan. I just wanted to see your reaction.
Well, you got it. I almost hit end. Let's start this call again. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, the memes of him reacting to LeBron in The Last Dance are just like, where he's just like laughing with like a cigar in his mouth, are just priceless.
It is the greatest. So
the only one who could even remotely rival, you know, I grew up in Southern California, so I was a Lakers fan, but you know, Kobe, all, you know, praise to Kobe, great basketball player. But yeah, Michael Jordan, absolutely. LeBron to me is not even. There are a few other people in line before.
Yeah. Maybe that's a philosophy podcast another time. Maybe. You know, because you could probably pull into it how people could use their concept of time through your understanding and philosophizing on that, maybe through Kant's view or maybe just your own. as to how, you know, the, because I think the people that propose some of the cool conversations around that, when you're like, oh, who's the greatest? It's really strong of an argument when people bring in how the answer to that is only the present time and through your experiences. You know what I mean? So when someone comes in is like, you know, well, I was around when Oscar Robertson was playing basketball. You know, they offer this such deep color to like what it meant to be the greatest at that point in time. And they can layer on like the effect they had on the sport and the deep embedding principles that, you know, Michael Jordan didn't even know he had based upon. Like it creates this like, geez, you know, that was pretty strong, you know? And, yeah. And then of course, you know, you get the pizzazz NBA era, Johnson, Bird, Jordan era. And it's like, you know, it's kind of tough to like argue against that one as the base support of the possible, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And who are we to know that, like, let's just say we're removed from this and 7 years later from this day, LeBron continues to do and does more, you know, in multiple ways. He rewires himself and team play and whatever out of COVID, more in person, and it just grows in, you know, in power. Maybe our concept will change in 7 years. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Time changes that. So I think it's always a good argument inside of the greatest of all time.
Yeah. No, I think that's, I mean, obviously with Brady winning again, there are always these discussions about Babe Ruth and all these other players from different sports and how does time affect it? So yeah, I definitely think that's an interesting discussion.
Yeah. You know, the Babe Ruth one is a tough one, right? Like imagine making that comment of anything different, you know? Yeah. Cy Young was the greatest. Well, how are we going to tie that intro into the cop topic today? Do your best.
Well, today we're going to talk about morality and fitness. And all I can say is I'm just glad that I didn't officially end our podcast after a year by being serious about LeBron James. That would have just like, okay.
Maybe quick. We did. Maybe just we did. Maybe we have such good editing skills that we brought it back up.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, guys. So today we're going to start talking about morality and fitness. So obviously in a number of previous episodes, whether it's intention or autonomy or virtue, we've discussed this topic before. We've discussed Aristotle in a bit of detail, although I'm sure we'll come back to him. Utilitarianism when we talked about impact, but also some other episodes. Today we're going to focus a bit more on Kantian moral philosophy and its relation to the notion of duty and, you know, do we have an obligation to, you know, be fit? And what obligations do we have within fitness? That type thing. So I suspect this will probably be a two-parter at least. And then James and I were just talking before the call about Hume and his moral philosophy, which is a whole interesting thing in and of itself. And I'm sure we'll probably do something on him later on down the line as well.
Yeah. And does this also tie into the political discussion we had? Like how your actions may affect others and not affect others for that, you know? When you said duty and obligation, that's immediately what I thought about too.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, a very important area of philosophy. You know, we've talked about philosophy as the nexus of sorts where different disciplines meet, and an important discussion within philosophy is how morality and politics relate to each other, because they're obviously not coextensive. It is not illegal to just, you know, lie to someone's face outside of it being in a contract or something.
Yeah.
But it is immoral. So, you know, and there are lots of things that are legal, but are not, you know, short selling and things like that are of questionable morality. So yeah,
right.
They obviously relate to one another, but they're not coextensive. And how do those two play a role? So absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I'm interested in revisiting that idea as it's regarded to fitness.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too. I think, just for people who may not know, and you know, I tied in some ideas from this as well. You did a knowledge series on this as well. So yeah. that's another great discussion on this.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's just start off with a base definition of morality. So the quality of being in accord with standards of right or good conduct, a system or collection of ideas of right and wrong conduct, virtuous conduct. So it basically has to do with how we conduct ourselves, usually with regard to others. Although, as we'll talk about, it has historically, and it still today does involve one's relation to oneself. How can one and how should one treat oneself ethically? Much more recently, it's come to encompass things like how does one treat inanimate objects ethically? Well, inanimate, maybe not the right term, but like non-conscious. So, you know, the environment, let's say, but also, you know, certain animals, obviously, some of which are more conscious than others. So it has to do with how do we, typically it's most concerned with how do we relate to other people, but it is also concerned with how we relate to ourselves. And again, increasingly now the environment and, you know, animal ethics, things like that are also of concern.
Yeah.
So when you think about philosophy, there are a lot of different things that go in within philosophy, but I would say morality is probably one of the most central discussions within philosophy. And
why do you think that is? Just to try to get at the some of the deepest burning questions of what's the base support of right and wrong for how we go about this.
It's a good question. I mean, I think it's partially a mix of,
it's almost like a meta philosophy question.
Yeah, I mean, I
think about philosophy.
I think there's, you know, historical accident aspects to it. I mean, just like logic used to be a part and then it branched off and math used to be a part and what used to be called natural philosophy is now science. But, you know, the biggest questions about who we are originated in one way or another, typically in some sort of philosophy, like where did we come from? How do we conduct ourselves while we're here?
Yeah.
Where are we
going?
That's
what I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Origin and meaning. Yeah. A lot of those, the base support of where this all came from. Yeah. I'm just interested in that.
Yeah, and it's I think just something that you made me think of as you were mentioning that I think we mentioned in previous episodes, in particular on politics, like peaceful transfer of power, rule of law, like all these things are exceptions in history, right? Yeah. Like it wasn't, you know, for a long period of time, there wasn't necessarily so much of a question of like, how should we act in like a systematic fashion? And then like, I'm sure, you know, obviously we don't know the minds of long ago hunter-gatherers, but I'm sure proto versions of the question were being asked, but it didn't really come along in systematic cultural form till a lot later. So this idea of how should we as people, you know, conduct ourselves with respect to others, at least in a systematic, written out, you know, throw it on the piece of paper type way, is a relatively recent development.
Yeah, or stones.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Let's call it more of a, you know, entry into this, into civilized manner.
Right.
Yeah.
And within philosophy, there's this notion of normativity that we've discussed before, you know, descriptive versus normative statements, descriptive being, descriptive statements being about what is the case, like the sun is shining right now in Northern Indiana, or the earth is a sphere, and normative statements being about what should or should not be the case. Now, I wanted to mention this in particular in relation to fitness, and we'll get to this question to talk about to what extent are there norms within fitness? Is there normativity within fitness? And then what type of normativity? Because not all normativity is created equal. So I have some examples here. You know, there's the normativity, if you want to call it that, of rationality, like, if you want to go to Australia, you should buy a plane ticket. If you want to become a lawyer, you should go to law school. That's one type of normativity where it's dependent on the goal or the context. Etiquette is a type of normativity. If you want to be a decent member of society, don't pick your nose in public. But no one would say that that reaches the level of normativity of ethics, right? Mm-hmm. There's religious normativity. If you want to please God, avoid eating pork or give to charity or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, ethical normativity is pretty strong. That's typically our intuitive feel of what's going on. It's not just, you know, some cultural custom where it's like, you know, if you travel somewhere, it's impolite to resist food. That may be impolite, but it's not like, you know, stealing something from someone. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
Like those levels of normativity differ. So I think a question, you know, we'll get to when we talk more in depth about fitness will be like, A, is there any normativity in fitness? And if so, is it like morality? Is it like etiquette? What's it like there?
Yeah. Is it fair to like include the sentence, is it normal to ... and then whatever you're going to discuss? I was just trying to think of a language as to how normativity, the word itself, is not common for my usage or my understanding. And I think that limits me a little bit in its usage. So I was just trying to find a workaround to say, you know, is it normal to ... Is that the question you ask to see if that particular thing contains normativity in this context?
It could be. I think that's definitely related.
Am I just trying to hijack in something that looks like normativity as a word to my, kind of make it?
No, I definitely think it's related. And I do actually think that is something I want to discuss in the future. And that is a big discussion within philosophy, where sometimes we talk about the purposefulness or the teleology of biological systems, like a heart should pump blood, mm-hmm. a brain should fire neurons. And yeah. Not just that it does, it should. So like when we say, is it normal for, you know, people to be up at 2 a.m. in the morning? No, it's not normal. So there is that sense of it. I think that's within normativity, but then there's kind of the broader sense that's just concerned with how should the world be versus how is it? So religion's making claims about how people should behave. Etiquette's making claims about how people should behave. Aesthetics is making claims about what is ugly, what is beautiful. So normativity is really just a fancy way of saying like should or ought in various different spheres. That's really
the ought of the is ought conversation.
Exactly.
Got it.
Exactly. So today we're mainly going to be talking about Kantian ethics. Now, as you might imagine, this could be a semester or multi-semester thing. So we're not going to go through the entire thing here, but I'm just going to give people some ideas of what's going on in Kant's system. And just in terms of reading there, Kant does have, you know, it's a little bit of a slog, but it's short. He's got a work called The Groundwork for the Metaphysics of Morals, which something like 60 to 80 pages. So if people are listening and want to, you know, just work their way through, that's like a preface to his bigger work, The Metaphysics of Morals. That's like the big work of morality there, but that's a good one to go to. And then obviously the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy that I've been referencing many times has good work on Kantian ethics and good bibliography. I guess, yeah, I didn't think to include this, but just mini biographical stuff. Immanuel Kant was an 18th century philosopher who gave us major contributions in metaphysics, epistemology, moral philosophy, aesthetics, philosophy of religion, you name it, and is probably most famously known for his moral philosophy, at least in popular culture. And there are a lot of notions that we, you know, make reference to with regard to morality today that come from Kant. So just a few here that I'll outline. Autonomy, which we discussed on our episode, Autonomy and Fitness. The idea for Kant here being that it is crucial to morality that the law come from one's self. What one is to do morally come from oneself. And he thinks it actually mimics, you know, you could see how that gets tricky real quick, right? Because then someone's like, well, my morality differs from your morality. But he makes arguments to the effect of it's similar to logic and math, where the same way we can use our rationality to arrive at common truths of logic and math, we come to common truths of morality.
Yeah. It puts in the system, repeat, see how it works over time, and then see the end result based upon that and come to some conclusions.
Yeah, and he gets a lot of this from Rousseau, and you know, Rousseau talks about how true freedom really comes from giving the law to oneself, to giving someone some boundedness in which they have to act. Intention, that's a big one. Whenever you hear someone say it's the thought that counts, or it wasn't my intention, like, you know, it's not that people didn't think about this before Kant, but it's a huge aspect of his moral philosophy. We need to do the right thing for the right reason. And of course, we had an episode there, Intention and Fitness. So for Kant, it's not the outcome of an action that counts. It is fully and solely the intention. That's really the big thing.
Yeah.
Duty, which will be talking.
Sorry, do you think that's why you mentioned moral philosophy is so big today in the language? I think because just based upon our culture and society, you know, we're trying to find this nice base support as to what true intentions are with people.
That could be, yeah. I think there's a lot of confusion out there for people about, like, what are the relevant moral concepts and virtues, and should we count intentions more, outcomes more? And I think that's at least part of the reason why moral philosophy has become more, maybe popular is the right term today, but yeah, more studied.
Okay.
Have you ever seen or heard of the show, The Good Place?
No.
Okay. It's with, Ted Danson and, Kristen Bell.
Yep.
So I never thought it was possible to make a show that would be very good and entertaining about philosophy, but that's what the show's about. So if people are looking for an entertaining intro to Kant's ethics and utilitarianism and Aristotle, that's got a really lots of good stuff on this. So
solid. Thank you. I'm always looking for some interesting watches.
Duty. You know, it's central for Kant that we do the right thing because it is the right thing. And he makes this important distinction between acting from duty as opposed to acting in accord with duty. And just to give you an example, the difference between someone anonymously giving to charity and then someone giving to charity because the TV crews are there because their name is going to be up on the building, or someone returning a wallet because they think it's the right thing to do versus someone returning a wallet because there's a, you know, $100 reward or, you know, they'll be praised afterwards. So in other words, the idea being you're doing the right thing because it is the right thing.
Yeah. Which we talk about quite a bit in other podcasts, but just the current landscape for individuals for exercise, right? They think it's not worthy if no one has seen them or if it's not broadcasted of what they've done.
Right. And, you know, to clarify a common objection to Kant, you know, sometimes people say, well, do you have to hate what you're doing? Does it mean nothing good can come of it? It doesn't mean that, but it means ask yourself the hypothetical question. If you didn't get more followers, if you didn't get a reward, if you didn't get the money and all the rest of that stuff, would you still do it? If yes, then the action was moral. If not, then no, it ceases. Yeah. To
anybody and even with that question though, you're presuming they have the strong enough cognitive repertoires to understand, you know, what's not going to be there if they don't get the followers, you know,
right.
You make that presumption as well. Cause I even don't think that to step further in that, I don't even think people are have enough cognitive strength to even think about the perception of those differences.
Well, I mean, and that's a great point too, because one of the central features of Kant that we'll talk about when we talk about the categorical imperative, Kant is just, he zeroes in more than almost any other moral philosopher I know on this notion that humans are masters of self-deception. We are just fantastic at it.
Yeah, I got so many books up there, and I'll promise you, Robbie, I'll lay them out for us at the end. We can include them. But so many good current readings, I'm sure, on that base support notion for today. Yeah, it's crazy.
And so, you know, to your point, you know, it's one thing for, you know, let's say someone had the cognitive capacity to ask themselves that. They'd say, okay, well, would I do this if I didn't have more followers? Well, we do all sorts of mental gymnastics to be like, well, and, you know, it's wrong to lie to someone unless they're a jerk, or, mm-hmm. you know, it's wrong to lie, you know what I mean? Like just these little like mm-hmm. provisos in there. And that's one of Kant's central insights is that, no, we don't get to add those provisos to morality. And that's, mm-hmm. that's what we want to inject, but morality commands this. And yeah. So
yeah. That's cool.
Morality consists in respect for the moral law and acting from duty. It's not pleasure and happiness. So unlike Aristotle, unlike utilitarianism, so for Aristotle, leading the virtuous life intrinsically leads to true happiness and true, you know, eudaimonia. And for utilitarianism, we're looking for the greatest pleasure for the maximum number of people, or greatest happiness for the maximum number of people. That is not the ultimate goal for Kant. It's awesome if it leads to that too, but you are to be, you know, morality requires being moral for the sake of being moral, full stop. No other proviso in there. So he also says, he starts off, you know, the groundwork for the metaphysics of morals by saying the true absolute good, like one of the few truly good things without qualification in the world, is a good will, not happiness or pleasure. Mm-hmm. And a good will for Kant subsumes its temporary desires and wants to do the right thing.
Yeah. And that echoes back to, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but it does almost act as a truth behind the deepest intentions, because you can always get quabbled in this, like, you're doing it for others or doing it for the collective. And then it's like, well, is that the correct, you know, even if it is on a good base support, is that the correct intention? So yeah, that the way you describe that, definitely, I appreciate that, because it does resonate with me more. If I was just to say, like, what feels good to me in my understanding, it's definitely Kant's view on that. Like, it's great if it does. Stop. No, nothing more. I'm just making mention of why that may resonate for me.
Yeah, and I mean, I've seen in previous episodes, I think we've discussed, like, I think a lot of what you have put forward as some of your central ideas with relation to fitness bear a lot of resemblance to what Kant has to say with regard to autonomy, intention, and right reason, and things like that. And it's very anti-utilitarian in that regard. So obviously utilitarianism comes like roughly a century later after Kant, so he wasn't around for it, but it's Kantian utilitarianism are about as oil and water as you can get. Now, there are some people who try to blend them and do other things, but they really are like, you do the right thing for the right reason, whether, you know, it leads to good consequences or not.
Yeah, yeah. Just that as a time conversation again, which just think about that, like 100 years later, of how many thoughts and readings and philosophizing and things that went on in 100 years, you know, that just changed a view on that. And people don't even recognize what, you know, we're possibly capable of in changing. Just look at the past, you know, past year as an example we talked about, right? Imagine 100 of those and what's possible for change in thought and whatnot. It's a mind-blowing but appreciative at the same time.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, there was certainly other moral philosophy in between Aristotle and Kant and utilitarianism, but
yeah.
Let's extrapolate your point. Like, Aristotle is a couple thousand years,
yeah, you
know, essentially, yeah, before Kant and utilitarianism, and like the time in between that, and then you get these other two, and yeah, it's crazy to think about how much that shifts things.
Gosh, yeah.
Okay, so those are just some central highlights of Kantian moral philosophy. The main one that I wanted to talk about today, and then we're going to launch into the fitness side of things, is the categorical imperative, which is probably one of the most famous aspects of Kant's philosophy. And I wanted to break it down for people because it's a weird term that initially doesn't make sense, but when you break it down, it makes a lot more sense. And we'll see how it plays a connection to what we want to talk about in fitness. So let's talk about categorical imperative. So first of all, what is an imperative? It's just a old-timey word, if you want to say that, for a command. That's all we're talking about. So examples: open the door, turn on the lights, don't talk while chewing, just a command of some sort. So that's what an imperative is. What does categorical mean? Categorical means in all situations, no matter what. So what is a categorical imperative? It would be a command that applies in all situations. Now, the central questionnaire is, does such a thing exist? Because on the face of that, that seems really weird. All commands that you can think of have some context or goal that they are related to. And this will relate to fitness and health, of course, where we talk about, like, what's the context? What's the goal? What are you trying to accomplish? So a hypothetical imperative, which is another version that Kant talks about, is a command that applies only in certain situations. So if you want to read Kant in the original language, go learn German. If you want to lose weight, eat healthy food. If you want to be a lawyer, go pass the bar exam. But whether you are bound by any of those commands depends on your wants, desires, and goals. If you get rid of the goal to read Kant in the German, you don't need to learn German. If you don't care about losing weight, go eat whatever you want. So almost every command you can think of is a hypothetical imperative. For Kant, what is unique about morality is that a categorical imperative is what gives us the best description of moral commands. It's a command that commands you to act a certain way in all situations. So don't steal, no matter what. Not if you want to be a good person, don't steal. Not if the person you're stealing from is a jerk, it's okay. Not inserting all these little provisos to, you know, get yourself out of the rule. Don't lie, no matter what. It's not if you want to live a happy life, don't lie. It's not if the lie won't hurt anyone, lying is okay. And then lastly, don't murder. It's not don't murder if you want to be a polite member of society, don't murder. It's not if the person did something really bad, it's okay. It's just don't murder, full stop. So Kant thinks that a central feature of moral imperatives, unlike every other imperative that you can think of, is that you're still duty-bound to act morally, whether you want to or not. It is binding on you as a rational being, full stop. You can't be like, well, I don't want to go to Australia, so I don't need a plane ticket. That totally works in that context, but it doesn't work in the case of morality. And the reason he thinks this is because he's acutely aware of our propensity to insert these little clauses and to find ways around being bound by morality. So one of the things we'll talk about today is, are there any such duties within health and fitness? Are we duty bound as humans just to better ourselves? Or is it just context dependent? Is it just dependent on our goals?
Yeah.
So a lot in there.
Yeah, no, I mean, first of all, that was, I think you asked yourself the question in as a hope strategy that it would be understood. In my perspective, I think you did a great job of giving me a good foundational knowledge of categorical versus hypothetical imperatives. I think you gave a good understanding of the stance, I guess, that Kant would say in the understanding of categorical imperative with your examples: don't murder, don't steal, don't lie. And then, the challenge of how, if it's time, how we carry that over to, if it's, I guess I'm asking that question, is it time where we kind of jam on carrying those duties, you know, what are duties and obligations for fitness? I think you've given a good base support as to what we can come up with as to what could be those, you know?
Yeah. I'm ready to jam on that. The only other thing I was going to mention is, the categorical imperative, like the formulation of it that Kant comes up with, that basically everything about his morality spills out from this. Always act in such a way that you treat another human being always as an end in themselves, never merely as a means. If you had to sum up Kant's moral philosophy in a sentence, that's it. So I'll read that again.
Yeah.
Always act in such a way that you treat a human being always as an end in themselves and never merely as a means. Anything you would ever want to think about morality flows out of that. Don't lie, don't steal, don't murder. It means always treat a human being as a being with ends and goals that and purposes that they have in and of themselves, and never merely as a means to your own ends and goals and purposes. purposes. And that is the categorical imperative, the central one from which all others derive.
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah, I immediately think about that in some conversations that have come up before of, you know, people, having the opportunity to make decisions on, you know, doing exercise and being consistent or eating good foods, but they choose not to. And I think that's where it gets a little, I think it goes back to the conversation that we had on the rights that people have to do what they want to do. And those rights of not exercising and not eating, you know, what nature gives us, you know, and what that leads to, I guess that's where my brain is like hurting a bit on, well, why even discuss it if, I guess it's not why even discuss it, but you know, where does it land if we're just eventually not gonna push anything that says, well, there are these duties that people have. If am I making sense? If we still fall back on like, well, they can do whatever they want, you know? And I mean, it'd be very simple for me, Robbie, to say that just like I'm sure, well, I'm not sure, but in the scientific process for other areas, you just look over time, what has worked, what's the long-term goal strategy? And then just say, well, these are the principles that people have been doing in order to get them there. And so your duty is to do these things. Why? Because it's been shown to be true for a really long period of time that those are the things that, you know, but as far as saying that those are even something similar to don't steal, don't lie, don't murder, I don't know. It just feels like it's not even in the same category when we're talking about fitness. So two things in there, I guess, where should we set our thoughts based upon that, like, you know, I guess it's the duty obligation area, right? And what we talked about before in you know, freedoms and what, you know, and political view on, you know, what people should do based on that. And then secondarily, I do think that there are things that people, we've just seen over time, like, you know, we have biceps and we rotate and our feet move in a certain manner to move us across land. We can bend, squat, et cetera. You know, and I could pile on that story as to like, well, these are things that have been around, we actually can do. And it does, if we do these challenges, lead to these things, you know, but that's not in like clear evidence.
Yeah. So, I mean, I have a couple of thoughts there about how we navigate things. One is, I think I see your concern going back to like, you know, the rights question and the legal question of like, well, if we can't force people to do it, you know, people are legally allowed to do what they want. I do actually think we can make some headway here in a way in which we couldn't there, but like had to talk about like, you know, how much leeway do we have? So just to refresh people's memory, part of what we were saying there is that what we ran into is that when you're talking about, you know, any group of people living together in a, you know, liberal, democratic, modern society is that people have different conceptions of the good, and laws can only be instituted to the extent that you are infringing upon the rights of others. And unless you are doing so, you should be allowed to not wear a seatbelt, you know, buy a big gulp, so on and so forth. Now, you know, the details get, you know, tricky there. And we talked about taxation and education, all these other different things. But with morality, we actually have more purchase here, because here we're not talking about making any laws. And with normativity, just in general, not even morality, with normativity, the normativity is going to apply independently of any particular society. It may just apply insofar as you're a human being, the same way, you know, Kant's morality applies insofar as you're a rational being. So there's a way in which we could talk about there being duties that one has to oneself that have nothing to do with what laws are being instituted or not instituted in that conundrum of like, how do we as lawmakers impose other things on others. So we could still, you could still very much in the realm of normativity and or morality say something like, someone is duty bound to maintain and cultivate their health and fitness, whether they choose to or not, and whether any laws are instituted about that or not. So I think that's one way.
Oh no, that's yeah. I'm glad you went about it that way of putting it into that manner. And maybe I'm just stuck at it. That's what you just said, your last sentence is what if it's not obvious, I believe, right? I deeply believe in it, that we have a duty and an obligation to challenge ourselves physically because we can, right? Because we are capable of doing it. And therefore, this is my point of like, maybe I'm having a hard time of looking for the stretch of it. And I know why I'm having a hard time to stretch for it, Rob, because no one practices it. Like it's very few humans that, like it's a very small percentage, you know? And I think that's where I'm just having a hard time of thinking about putting it into practice and it moving beyond just the thought, but maybe that's not where I should stop myself. But yeah, I think people do have a duty and an obligation to go through those physical challenges, because we've seen through a long period of time, even through the change of having to do it to survive, to now like doing it through folly, which I think is the major, like major difference between 2020 and 1655, is that there is a stark difference in having to do it to like challenge yourself physically. And it doesn't just happen. Like we don't get up and carry water for 3 miles and then have to go burrow tubers for 4 hours, you know, in a squat bending position, you know, to source our food, if I'm making sense of, you know. And I think that's where the issue is that we have to come up with ways, like our vocation and our life and our day-to-day doesn't require us to move through physical challenges, right? That have these great outcomes. So herein lies the biggest issue, which goes back to the knowledge theory I originally said, we don't have to exercise. So now inside of that practice, in dealing with morality of it, where does that lie? Because our intentions, we can't trick ourselves, right? We can't be like, this is a tree. I'm doing one arm rows and I'm like, I'm cutting wood for my family. I'm cutting wood for my family. Like it's, you know what I'm saying? So it does go back to Kant's points on, well, what's the deepest intentions inside of it? Stop there because I'm maybe rambling, but I'm just kind of, thinking where I lay on that one.
Yeah, I mean, so two thoughts there. One would be, you know, going back to your worry or concern about, well, because not a lot of people do it, I'm having a trouble like bridging the gap there. Similar thing in morality. I mean, you know, Kant would just come along and say like, yeah, just because there are very few moral exemplars doesn't mean we aren't bound any more or less, right? Just because it's hard for most people to act morally. And it's hard precisely because as humans, our desires naturally pull us in the opposite direction of what is the right thing to do. So it's far more common, not necessarily to say that, you know, all humans are immoral, that would be, you know, no. too far, but yeah. You know, he does say something to the effect of humans are metaphorically kind of crooked wood. How do you straighten things out? How do you get humans to act according to reason? But even there, you know, you'd still say they're, you know, duty bound to act in such a way, whether they choose to or not. And then I actually think there is another interesting Kant connection in what you were saying about the fact that we don't have to. Maybe we finally in human history get to attach some normativity and morality to fitness, because there's not much in it if you have to do it, right? You know what I mean? Like Kant famously says that about a lot of different things. Like if someone has no choice but to do, you know, X, Y, or Z, and if they're just doing it because they're forced to, where's the morality in that? You know, where's the choice? Where's the volition? Where's the giving the law to oneself? So in a certain sense, maybe now that we are faced with this, like we're sitting all the time, you know, all these desires are pulling us in the opposite direction. There's more normative oomph or morality or whatever you want to call it to the fact that, you know, people are saying, no, I need to cultivate my health. I need to cultivate. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Somewhat,
sort of, maybe.
Yeah, no, for sure. I guess I was looking for like the, no, it totally makes sense. It totally makes sense. It just, yeah, I need a second to think about how I'm looking for how this conversation adds more to trying to get people to a point of, you know, asking more questions and digging in a little bit more to the reason as to why they're embarking on health and fitness. Yeah.
Well, I mean, let's start here. Like, we kind of touched on it, but like, is there any sort of normative duty, whether etiquette related, probably not religious, although maybe there are some religious duties to fitness. Mm-hmm. We could talk about those, but like,
yeah, you could. Interpretation of scripture would say there's places in there that could connect to that.
Outside of someone wanting to adopt particular goals, like, oh, I want to be healthier. Oh, I want to lose weight. You know, outside of people wanting to adopt those specific goals, do they have any sort of duty to cultivate their own health and fitness? And if so, what sort of normative thing is that? Is it like etiquette? Is it like morality? Like where does, you know what I mean? Like normativity sits on a spectrum. I see what you were saying before about don't lie, don't steal, don't kill being on like the very far end. But you know, there are, you know, so what, is there a duty for us to cultivate those things? If so, what is that duty consist in, and what is it like?
Yeah, well, I'll start with the one on, but I still may need your help in trying to see where that sits and if it's actually implementable. And I think that's why I'm getting tripped a lot, because I'm just saying words, but as far as it being implementable, you know, anyways, it's about, and I think I'm cheating a little bit here because you offered J.G. Bennett's language inside of the document. I've read, I'm not well read on it, but I have constantly used a number of his, you know, five or six sentences on, and what it essentially I captured in words is what I use for people having potential, meaning, you know, each person has a constant opportunity, in my belief, to discover something more about themselves in their physical capabilities, which I do think, in my own opinion, leads to better thought-making processes and how they navigate their life. And it doesn't always happen through physical challenges. It's obvious that I'm biased in that, and that's, I mean, the world of physical culture, so it makes sense of that. So I do think, yeah, that there's a duty for people to try to uncover constantly this potential and fall nothing short of continuing to go after what's possible and not leave stuff on the table. And I see a lot of humans being okay, and an entire culture and society with everyone being okay with mediocrity, like this being upright and doing this and checking the boxes is enough. And so, and I'm saying, no, there's more. And your duty is to do more, to challenge yourself physically every day. But again, this will go back to, well, how are you going to come up with a way of saying that's a why, if really, you know, I'm not providing, and, you know, I can't really create any evidence that says, well, if 7.8 billion people for the next 200 years all really applied that concept, there'd be something better. Well, I think there would be, but I don't, you know what I'm saying? And there's 3% really that are probably think about that thought and are willing to just go at, and let's use a number, instead of going after, you know, trying to search for 92% of their human potential for their whole life. Just putting it in that word potential, not worrying about physical, cognitive repertoires, emotional capabilities, et cetera. I think a lot of people are okay with 51. That's my honest opinion. Because it's enough. It's enough for what's actual challenges are today. You know, because if you have problems cognitively, there's medicine for that. If you have problems physically, you know, there's medicine for that too, but you don't actually need to be physical in order to operate that much, in generalized statement. So I think within there, I answered your question of what my beliefs are for, I think there's a duty around this nonstop push towards their own potential.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the interesting questions in there lie around, like, there are lots of things that we can do as humans, but not necessarily, it's certainly not the case that if you can do something, you should do something. So there's something obviously interesting within fitness about, like, you know, how closely related that is to our biology and who we are as humans, right? Like, I can go learn all the details of, you know, Final Cut Pro or how to do a Broadway dance production, but that doesn't mean I should, you know what I mean? But I think what might be interesting about fitness and saying that there are duties for us to cultivate, you know, and optimize our health and fitness is that, you know, there's something deeply embedded in us biologically that relates to those aspects of who we are from an evolutionary perspective, biological perspective, things like that. That to me seems like the interesting little way to get into the conversation. Because again, there's lots of things that we could go out and learn or optimize or get better at, but doesn't necessarily mean that we should, but there might be something unique about fitness and health that is different from those.
Yeah. And you're helping there, because that is my issue. Like, why I'm stumbling and why I'm stuck is that, cause I always use that, right? Like, and to me, that's, you know, I have to recognize that's only the way I see things. You know, it's not that others will understand it. I'm trying to create clarity in my language so that people can learn about this concept. But yeah, you and I agree. And there's others too, the way I lay it out of, you know, we had to do those things. And, you know, just based upon time, as time has gone on, like, you know, just look at us, right? I mean, you could just observe it and watch us in play and do these movements. Like, we have, with a lot of practice, figured out what we can and can't do, you know, physically. And then what do we learn from all that? That leads to something that's really higher order, you know? And then I've put a stab at that. I've defined what that is, right? Say, this is the higher order point, is, you know, being consistent, learning and upgrading, right? That talks about potential. And I think that's where I'm stuck. It's like, it takes, and that's why I immediately just jump ship and be like, I wish the zombie apocalypse would happen. Like, cause it would at least be like a, you know, holy shit. I should have taken 10 years to learn how to run all out for 20 minutes. You see what I'm saying? Like, oh, now people can survive because they can run for 10 minutes straight, because we know zombies can't last more than 2 minutes, right? At a 4.5 to 5 minute per kilometer pace. We know this. We know these things. They actually implode, right? They try to keep pace. They overheat. They have thermoregulatory issues. Anyways, I just know these things. That's where I'm having problems is seeing, like, gosh, to me, it just makes so much sense. You know, like, it's so simple. Use that evolutionary thing, the biological concept. This is how we move. We've seen all this. Here's plants and animals. This is how we do it. Keep stress low. Do it every day. you know, and I think people have a duty to do that. But then it gets, you know, it just gets, I just get lost after that.
Well, I think it's heading in the right direction. And I mean, I think one thing I wanted, we'll probably discuss in more depth in the next episode, but probably a bit today, is a lot of this goes back to questions. And this is an area of discussion within philosophy about like capabilities and responsibilities. Like what are humans capable of and what do we have responsibilities to do? Like, I'm capable of building a house. Am I responsible for building it? You do know what I mean? Like, so yeah. doing some deeper investigation into like, there are things that we are capable of that, you know, if you lived a human life where you never did it, cool, you know, and maybe for some of those things, all the better for it, like torture or what have you. But
what happens if you're capable of things with contractions and aerobic work that we know will lead to better humans?
Yeah, so that's really like, that's the interesting question, is fitness and health seems to be, certainly it's among the things that we are capable of, just like these other things, building a house or, you know, doing a Broadway play or what have you. But unlike those other things that would be interesting and, you know, kind of a something you could do, fitness and health seems to elevate itself above those other things in terms of its relation to our history and our biology and what sort of life we can lead as a result of engaging it in it. So I think that's where the kind of philosophical work comes in, is like, so why is fitness like that? Just the same way moral philosophers ask, like, why is morality like that? Why should we even bother with this? Like, it makes our life harder. We have to do more difficult things. Like, we have to not steal money and make our life easy and, you know, not sleep with a whole, you know what I mean? Like, there's a whole ton of things we can't do as a result of moral strictures that actually in a number of senses make our life harder. And yet there seems to be this, you know, virtue and long-term value in that thing. So I think that's really where the discussion will ultimately lead, is there are all sorts of things that human beings can do, but among those, there's a subset that, you know, we should be engaged in for a normal human life. And it isn't dependent on culture. It isn't dependent on time. It isn't dependent on place. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, morality, maybe health and fitness, that's where we get kind of the interesting discussion, I think.
Yeah. And that led me to the Rhodes years back of looking at intention, you know, and because the conversation, as you were saying, and I was like, yeah, but, you know, you look around and I just thought, what would, you know, just coaches on the street say to your comment? And I think a lot of them would be like, you know, just stop worrying because people are moving. And to me, that's not enough, you know, and because a lot, I would suffice to say, it's like north of 90% of a lot of people who do movement or daily exercise activity. Remember the Jimmy on the street?
Yeah.
If you're to ask them like what they're doing, I can damn well tell you it's not about because they know they're capable of doing it. No, and I think that's where my frustration is the exhaustion I feel in trying to come up with the concepts to get people on board of, you know, as a large whole, not 1,000 coaches in CCP, but like a big whole, a lot of people to that growth and understanding of them being capable of doing it. But you know, it helped me a little bit of maybe it's because Immanuel Kant one time said it. It's like, just because not a lot of immoral people doesn't mean that this moral philosophy still can't stand, you know? That made me feel a little bit better. It's like, yeah, of course. But I don't know, I just have a dismay at the challenge behind getting people on board with the understanding of capability, Robbie. And that's why... And that's what I mean by capability. I'm glad you said that, because when I say, do it because you can and do it because it's for you, that now that I'm looking at it from a larger lens, that's a Kant philosophy, right? Like, because it talks about a categorical imperative, right? Because you can, right? That states because you are capable of it. Now, in the continuum of normativity towards don't murder, don't steal, don't lie, I mean, it's far over here, but you get my point. And then because it's for you talks about that. I mean, and you're going to do it because it's great if it just does. And then full stop. That's it. After that, it's just for you. Nothing else, you know, nothing else. So anyways, thanks for making me at least realize that's where that came from. I didn't even know that's where, you know, that was my base support for it, was that history of intention and my dismay in not seeing enough people getting okay with understanding that they're capable. Yeah. Of expressing themselves every day. And yeah.
And there's also very much in, you know, what you were just talking about, well, people are moving, but they're not doing it for the right reasons, that there very much is that like acting from duty versus acting in accord with duty bit from Kant, where yes, you may be engaging in activity, which from the outside seems as though it is the desired, you know, activity. It is lacking the proper intention and therefore is lacking what we are searching for. So that element I would say is definitely there. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, I understand the frustration of getting more people to do it, but yeah, I think whether Kant certainly said it, but others have said it too, like, just because, you know, in different ages and eras, more or less people steal or kill or what have you, that doesn't change anything about the normativity about whether you should. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, we are in an age and era where for this period of time, people are not engaging in those activities. But, you know, if these are in fact duties that apply to us just insofar as we are human beings, that fact about the world does not change that normative bit.
Mm-hmm. So yeah.
I think another,
it's great that we made that the statement. You know, we, you know, well, anyways, I did. That's a categorical imperative in my perspective. You know, you should physically move every day.
So we've talked about it in a bit in relation to like the notion of duties to oneself. I'm curious, do you feel like there are any, and maybe I'll clarify before I say it, because I know a lot of, you know, what you say, do it because you can, do it because it's for you. A lot of that's trying to contrast with because your doctor said so, or because your wife is nagging you and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I do think even mentioning that, there is this interesting question, because ethics and morality is concerned with not just duties to yourself, but duties to others. Do you think we as humans not only have duties to ourselves to be fit and to engage in physical activity, but we have duties to others, whether family or tribe, or to maintain our health and our fitness, and maybe a higher order sense than like my wife is nagging me, or, you know, my boss is nagging me, or my doctor says so, or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I definitely do. I speak about a framework of that in a different analogy, through a coach's lens, and a coach's growth. And I'll try to apply that here because it's the same understanding, and I'll just be short on it. Yeah. I do think there's room for that, but not unless you're at 100% of yourself. Like not until that thing is like a slick, well-oiled, well-functioning, you know, well-operating system. So that's what I would quickly say. So in that, yeah, it's a stepwise progression and it's a timeline. And I'll use the analogies I do with coaches, and maybe that'll help to your question of where does it, you know, for others come in, is that word other is right after the self. Right. So, you know, for the coach example, a coach's growth, a coach will continually have to work on themselves. And I just loosely call it keep strengthening their level of competency, their consistency, and their understanding of caring, the three C's, right? They got to keep going for that, all that as much as possible, or as long as the relationship is, as long as the vocation is. Now, once that gets to, you know, pretty great levels where it's a system that is just operating, upgrading, it, you know, things can come in and you see how it fits in and you move it up, move things up. I think then is when you can start teaching and helping others. Then and only then, right? And when I say others here, this may be a point of interest for your question. I think we've lost the idea behind, you know, getting good in our suit first, and then first taking care of those who are in your immediate vicinity, like really close to you. That's your significant other, you know, the intimacy. That is your reproductive offspring, right? Your family. That is where you came from, your immediate family. So those really, really close to you, whatever that is, that doesn't have to be family. I'm just trying to give you a context of like the first step in others. Let's call it others 1.0. And then others 2.0 is like your community members, those around you in person, you know? And I think, yeah, you do then, after your big self is built, have a commitment, you know, a duty to spread the good news outside of that. And then, you know, and this doesn't happen that often, because we short track it, right? We take these well-intentioned humans with 3 months experience and say, I want you to run a business that's a system, which jumps over themselves and it jumps over others and it goes right to a system, right? It's like, you can do this, press play, money, you know? And they go backwards, like, what happened in this? And you know what happened? You didn't work on yourself. You didn't have that thing built really strong and powerfully before you then worked with those right around you, before you then decided to go into the system and have some kind of effect. Now, there's another level to that, which I call the collective, and that's the big grandiose concept of fitness. And I saw that in your notes to our duty to the fitness collective. I think on paper and as a concept, it's great. You know, it's like, oh yeah, that makes sense. But Robbie, I'm even hesitant to like explain that out, because I just, again, I see so much lack of self growth and like really working on oneself and figuring out where you lie and what's important to you and what matters to you, and really saying like on firm ground, this is what I think I have a duty to do. Like I got to do this for me, you know, this is the thing. And then when you get there and you get practice of it, then yes, I think there's a conversation, but I'm always hesitant, Robbie, to say that. So that answers the question on where do others and the systems and collective fit into that on paper as a concept of something to shoot for. I think it's kind of cool, but yeah, not a lot of people get that real super self-growth first, which I think then, you know, means that I would say if you never stepped outside of self and you didn't do it for others or anything else outside of that, it's probably going to be pretty effective for the majority.
Okay. So it seems like, at least on your conception, we could say something like, unlike most other moral or normative claims, which typically involve a duty or a should or an ought with relation to others, cultivating one's fitness and health has less to do, at least initially, with one's relation to others or any sort of duty to others, but has almost entirely to do with a duty to oneself.
Yeah. And I think it's because of the times. It's, you know, who we are, what we know, the generation, the tech information age, past 30 years, like it's all those things that would give me strength in having that. And also just looking around and seeing coaches trying to get, you know, people on board with the concept of health and fitness, or even the far stretching concept of autonomy. Like I could see the hurdles that have to be jumped they're just tremendous, tremendous hurdles. Yeah, before we even get to that conversation on, yeah, we want to do all this thing because it's going to contribute to all of us as a community thinking better thoughts and help one another and allow us to be mobile, more mobile in not only our physical being, but our thoughts and spread it out. And, you know, it's like, gosh, I think what we really need to take care of is our own stuff first. And there's room in there for another, you know, maybe offline or just another concept idea is like, what do we think are the relative and absolute totals of that self potential thing, you know, so that people can know like, well, what do you mean when you say that? When will I know I'm there? You know, cause I have lots of thoughts on that too, on how people will get there so that they can say, well, how do I know when I should be concerned about others and what's right and what's wrong and what duty do I have and what's the timelines on that? Cause I think that's a good question too.
Yeah. One question that you made me think of when you were saying, you know, you think, you know, the duty to oneself to cultivate one's health and fitness is especially applicable now, given kind of the current fitness landscape, is, you know, what if we went back 500 years, like you so often do, like, you know, typically when we think of normativity, well, this really, I mean, this to me is one of the interesting questions. So etiquette or societal customs, that's very indexed to like a time and a place, right? Whereas morality, you know, there are debates, but typically as we think of it, like slavery has always been wrong, whether people realize it or not.
Yeah.
Full stop. Do you know what I mean? So it's a similar, interesting question with fitness. To what extent is our duty to engage in fitness, does that change with time or place? Has it changed with time or place? Or is that more of a universal feature of human biology that, you know, we should engage in this no matter the time or the place?
Yeah, I think yes, time and place does matter. And if you try to go on a timeline, you know, from, you know, every 500 years and go back for, let's say, 4,000 or 5,000 years, it's only the last, well, so actually only the last 100, you know, of all those 8, 10, 12 multiplications of 500 year periods where we are actually asking this question of like, well, what should we do for physical activity? Like, you know, it wasn't even, as I say, the concept of doing physical fitness jumped from, you know, 1865, fitness was, you know, your strength to reproduce and survive. Boop, you know, to use Kant's, you know, your, it's a full stop, nothing more. It's like, okay. But then it kind of entered into like, oh, we do all these, and I call it folly, you know, do all these things, you know, really thinking we're going to be, you know, better at offspring and reproduction and we're going to survive better, you know? And we think all of that play, which we call whatever, has been that. So yeah, in time actually may not help the conversation because, or actually it does, but I'm just saying that I agree with you and you got to think of it in a way that we didn't have to do fitness, you know, because it wasn't even a word and it's just what we did. And I do think, based upon historical readings, you know, I do think people knew that these partaking in physical challenges, whether through labor or them observing, you know, farmers, right? Observing them over 20, 30 years, they're like, those are pretty resilient people, you know, like hardy and healthy and whatever. And I think there's been lots of examples of that, whatever you want to call it, where they were like the fittest, right? But now that's not needed. And you know, we don't need to plow the lands and we sit down and we just punch keys and that's a general statement, but when we get in the car and move around, take crap, you know, it's a lot of sitting and it's not a lot of requirements of physical movement. So I think, yeah, the looking at it in a time sequence does make us at least, you know, pop up some questions as to, you know, what duties do we have based upon, you know, based upon all that all that experience that we have.
Okay, so maybe it's, so it might, you know, in the scale of normativity, it might occupy this interesting position between morality and etiquette, where it's like morality in the sense that it applies to all human beings, just like Kant says morality applies to all rational beings. But unlike morality, it tends to, the state of moral duties is pretty, or the state of the fitness and health duties are pretty heavily influenced by time and place.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Do you understand my words on it? I just think I just need validation of that. When I say like, we are orchestrating this, you know what I'm saying? Like we're putting it together and planning it out. You know what I'm saying? As opposed to it just being what we do, just being done. And do you see the big differences in there and how I'm having a hard time like dropping some duties on top of it? If deep down we know we have to do it, like we're orchestrating it, where at one time it'd be more easy to categorically, you know, put it into a command because it was just done. This is, you know, I just reading Daniel Lieberman's research on looking at tribes, right? They brought over this treadmill and they were just talking to people like, well, you know, training for running. And they were like, training for running? Why would you run? Why would you run for exercise? Do you know what I mean? Like they actually answered in their own language that like, why would you run for exercise? That is just mind blowing, but it probably gives you a little bit of an idea, right? Of like, we just moved because we had to, you know? You had to do it and now it's manufactured. So that's where I'm having a hard time on trying to coming up with the intentions. If we all know that we don't have to, right?
Yeah. And that's, I mean, and maybe we'll get to this deeper down the line too,
but we do, we all know we don't have to, but we do, we still are doing it. Right. So that's what I'm saying. What's the base support of the intentions? And it really is folly. And I don't know if that'll pan out, you know, there's no real need, deep reason to do it. Sorry to keep, I know you had a thought there. Sorry to.
Oh no, you're okay. No, that's something I've wanted to ask you in terms of your conception of what would be the ideal, because on the one hand, when we talk about like autonomy and intention, you know, someone has like a conception of like, oh, I should be doing this. You know, I do it because I can, and it's for me. You're sort of with the autonomous concept, you're kind of the self-starter. You're the one intending to do it. So that's one conception of what seems like would be the ideal situation. But then the other is this non-reflective, non-rational, could be entirely preconceptual, just like people did it. So those two seem to be, and correct me if I'm wrong, they seem to be at odds with one another. Does that make sense?
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
So just making sense of like, which would be the thing we should try to strive for and what would be the ideal, because the pre-reflective, preconceptual, there's nothing, they just did it because they had to. There's nothing wrong about that, but then again, there's nothing autonomous about that either, right?
Well, I guess we'd have to time and place that one too, right? To decide upon what is autonomy, if it's an unknown and they don't know what they're doing, that is an argument for autonomy.
Okay, that I'd be interested to hear. Say a bit more about that.
Yeah, like I'm trying to give you a timeline of the farmer hundreds and hundreds of years ago, right? Like they're continuing to daily physically move, but just because they know they need to provide food for their home. You know, so it's, there's, I guess they got responsibility to the home and to the family, you know, but they're on their own doing it. They could stop, but they don't, you know, and it's just them. It's them doing it. So you know, in my mind, I guess it's hard to not say that's like the highest order version of autonomy, because they're just this unconscious competence.
Okay.
It's like the highest order. But yeah, but I think I can see why it's like it's shifty, because the concept of fitness autonomy for that farmer 500 years ago is almost weird to like timestamp.
But it's also usually, I mean, usually when you talk about usually when one talks about autonomy or intention, someone would be able to articulate, here's why I'm doing this.
Yeah. And that's this is why it's tough to time stamp that person, because they, I guess back the autonomy version back then is they don't even know why. But if we were to like go back in time and, you know, like, you know, it's like, that's all good. That's all like, that's all the good stuff, right? Eating good food, moving every day, family, you know, et cetera.
But I think even when we update this to the modern world, I think you've said something like this before, and again, correct me if I'm wrong or if I'm mischaracterizing, but you know, something in the future, like, you know, people just wake up in the morning and okay, we're going for a walk. Well, why are you doing that? Well, cause, nothing wrong with either conception, but that to me on the face of it seems to be at odds with autonomy and in intention, because in order to be autonomous and have intent, one would need to be conscious and be able to conceptually. So I guess that's where I'm trying to get a bit of clarity on that one.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there needs to be a good story, which would probably be, you know, better told. I'll try my best to put it down on paper sometime maybe, but like a fable of 500 years ago as to what autonomy was and how a person reflected on the concept of autonomy. And then for today, I say in the modern world, autonomy is that, but you left out that to get there, what I generally say is I start with the premise that we don't need to exercise and we just need to get over that fact. So you it's basically this. Yeah. I get up, I exercise. Why? It's just what you do. That's just what you do. Now, you go deeper and deeper into the intentions of it. I still think that person is autonomous. Why? Because they even know they have to, because they understand it's like beyond folly. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to hide behind the fact that in my own like thoughts on it, like that I can't make them understand that that their practice in this is going to somehow lead to this virtuous, really powerful life. I really do believe it will. But I basically want them to get to that point where they're just like, yeah, I know we just need to do, I don't need to do this, but I do. And let's just get on with it. So that's where I still end up with someone being autonomous. Like they're at an understanding. They understand the concept of like, you know what? I don't need to do all that, but I will choose to do so. Because, you know, I've learned and I've seen and I've played that I'm capable of doing these things. Look at this. Look, I can bend and I can squat and I can sustain for a long period of time. You know what I'm saying? But they don't have to somehow in their life come up with the deepest understanding of the why behind that to not be still autonomous. I still think they're autonomous. Even if their cognitive ability on my context of autonomy is not there. Am I making sense?
I think so. Yeah, I think I gotta chew that one over a bit more, because I think I see what you're saying. But yeah, we might, just like we've talked about before with words, there can be, you know, different senses. There's one sense of autonomy. I think there might be two different senses of autonomy that we're using. One, you know, when you said autonomy for you has to relates to this notion of unconscious competence. It's kind of that highest level when you go through that kind of consciousness competency model. That's true autonomy. And the autonomy I'm referring to, which is related but different, is this notion of being able to give the law to oneself, conceptually articulate why one is doing what one is doing, being conscious of the reasons and the intentions behind it. And unless one is able to, like Kant says, you know, just going through the motions and having no idea of why you're doing it would not be autonomous on that sense, on that sense. So just getting clear about like what autonomy we mean. Like a machine is, you know, if we mean just like, you know, a machine could be autonomous if we just mean like something going through the motions without having any reason, that, but that would not be a good outcome for autonomy. So yeah, just getting clear on like what autonomy
means. Yeah, for sure. And the word you use in there, which, and maybe it's not autonomy, maybe it's a very close like name that's next to it. But I do think in there, which requires more thought, is the word of intention and the understanding of the why, right? Like that's my point of modernity. Like, but that's why I say, I really don't think that the majority, it doesn't mean that people won't truly, in your definition, right, not get to autonomy, but I'm just being a realist in terms of, well, what's my definition in the modern world for most people who embark on this? And I'm saying that maybe there's room for them even understanding the deepest intentions. But this is the point, is that I'm okay with my defining of that for modern world if they're not super, if they're not at the deepest level aware of it, but they're like, they're getting there. But this is the point, they may never get there. And I'm okay with that in how I'm defining it, because I still do think that in the end, it'll be a good result. Why? Because they're just like, oh, I'm not sure, but you know, let's just get on with it. I'm not gonna stop and contemplate. That's gonna keep me from moving, right? And just because of the modern world, I just really don't think that there's the time, there's the system, there's the institutions, there's all that in place for people to get on board with that higher ordered, let's call it progressive scale of autonomy over time. So I'm not sure if that helps you in looking at it that way, but that helps me understand it in our differences of the language of autonomy. And I think the good word you used there, which is going to strengthen my language of it over time, is the intention and what their understanding is of the process, you know, and the why. And when they say it's just like breakfast, you know, I guess it's like, do we, you know, is of interesting to the breakfast conversation. I'm not trying to sidewind away from it now, but it's like, you know, if it's eggs from your animal and, you know, goat milk and homemade bread, get on with it. Good. Why? I don't know. Just what I do. It's breakfast. Seems to be serving me well. You know what I'm saying? So that's like, well, you're not really autonomous then. True. They're not. But maybe they're on their way, you know?
Yeah, no, and I see what you're saying about like there being gradations. And I mean, it doesn't need to be a binary thing where it's either zero, or one, or of autonomy. There can be different levels and scales and things like that. But I think, yeah, that's definitely something I want to chew over a bit more and discuss with you more in the future. Like getting a sense of like, what is the ultimate goal of, you know, what we would see being the ideal for long-term fitness practice? Is it just people are, it's so embedded within culture that people just get up and they have breakfast and they walk and they do whatever and they have no idea why, and just because we've transformed the culture? Or is it, because that's one conception. The other would be someone could articulate why those, why they're doing it and why they are not staying seated and why they are not eating junk. You know what I mean? Like having
a conceptual. And my projection is that there's maybe 2% of all humans who participate in the fitness thing for a while will get to that understanding.
Yeah,
I've been clear about that before. I mean, my percentages go lower and lower every time I discuss it. But I just don't think it's gonna. I just think we just have to get on with things. You know, this is like just keep doing it. You know, go do better things. Just be consistent and go do other things. Well, how much time should I spend on this why behind my exercise? You know, it's a practice if you want to get into it, but I just don't think, I just have a lot of hope for people and their ability to get to that awareness level. That's all. Now, outside of our little ecosystem, right? I just don't see it. So Yeah, but that's good. It's good to, I too will chew on that a little bit more for my language of it, because in my head before my voice, it does just make sense to me, and I can continue to clarify that. I just, one thing I'll add to it before is that that's why I think what I call like just stretching out these grandiose goals, right? Of what's the collective concept of autonomy. Remember that it actually jumped over that. It wasn't just people really understand it and they're taking care of themselves. Is their ability to actually teach others. Because in that, you know, that add-on, you know, you can see now it's jumped over self, which is on that pathway to what I'm calling a higher order version of autonomy, if I'm making sense. It's not just you, it's now beyond you, and you've learned so much, it's almost in duplication of reproduction, you know, of offspring. You're doing it so well, not doing it so well, you're doing life so well that you can pass this on. Like you can teach others about it, you know? And you don't have the coach shirt on. So that's what I continue on with that. Like, cause you just mentioned it, right? What I'm interested in your thoughts on the big, big grandiose long-term goal of the definition of that for autonomy. And it's actually further out than what we were just discussing there, which is the individual. It's them getting to the point where they're, and I just think of it, you know, in real life is like many, many years down the road, they're in their garage working out with their family and someone walks by, right? It's like, well, what are you guys up to? There it is, right? That's the little magic of the highest order form of autonomy. I'm doing this, I'm on my own. We do these physical things every day. Makes me feel good. You know, I can climb with my daughter and I can do these things and I have great thoughts. And I've noticed I've been a great person over a period of time with this, you know, practice, right? And the neighbor's like, give me some of that. Like, sign me up, you know? And there it is. So I'm just making mention of that too, that there's this long-term, you know, utopic goal of that, you know, that I don't forget, just in case people are like, oh geez, you know, I just want to stop short of just like saying, just get on with it. No, I'm not stopping short at that. I'm just being realist in terms of people's cognitive abilities to get there and understand it.
Yeah. And that, I mean, that helps clarify it a bit, because you literally could not give reasons to someone else unless you were conscious and aware of like, why, are, you know what I mean? Like if someone came along, I was like, you know, looking in your garage and they're like, why are you doing that? Well, just cause I don't know, my parents told me to do it. Like that's not gonna pass muster. So yeah. So I mean, that helps clarify, like someone eventually, the ideal goal would be someone would have, you know, it doesn't need to be like deepest scientific reasons or like deepest, you know, moral philosophy reasons, but just like reasons they are consciously aware of why they are engaging in that activity and they could explain it to someone else.
Yeah. This is another interesting place you can go, is that imagine all the coaches that I deal with who can't either get enough time, create enough time or take the time, to understand this idea that they should be on their own. You know what I mean? Just look at that. That's just an example of like where, you know, I can go to multiple areas that give me strength for my convictions that I have on how long will take people to truly get to that concept of the deepest understanding of autonomy. Like there's even folks within the practice of fitness who are going to be teaching others who can't get on board with that, even themselves. They're like, I can't do this myself. And there's no right or wrong to it, but it's just like, well, then when? And why do you think it takes all that to get to that? You know, it is just another area that we could look at that would strengthen my argument for what I would say the whole lot of people in projection over time are not going to get to that deepest understanding of autonomy.
Could be.
Maybe. But you know what? But you know what can get them quickly to that?
The CrossFit Open.
Beautifully placed. We're like Penn and Teller there. Just filling each other's words. family, exhaustion, community. Oh man.
All right. Well, any final thoughts there?
No, gosh. I don't feel pleasured or pleased or content. And I like that. But I said this going into, I got so much to work on for myself on this particular topic. And so, you know, I appreciate you taking the time to walk us through that and give me a year and come back with some strength.
Yeah. Honestly, you know, as we've talked about in our soundbite culture, like sometimes this stuff just takes time to like really mull over and think through. And like, there's questions I still have. And, you know, the fact that you don't feel pleased or pleasured, we did moral things today. That's a sign of morality, is that pleasure goes out the window and the moral thing.
And, you know, the fact that what connected us both was the concept of fitness morality. You know, we've now been kind of mulling around the whole thing for a year too. So that's also something that's of interest to this day and time. And I'm excited to see what it looks like over time.
Yeah. I just thought of the choker stuff at the beginning and the owner are not pleasured or pleased, and Brandon's going to
field day.
Just going to put those all together. And oh man, that'll become the new icon for the podcast.
No. You know, those emails you send me, I got this idea. What do you think about this
Yeah.
Oh, don't even send that one as a thought process. I'm not willing to go with that one, or answer to my wife on this picture. What was the thought based upon that? Oh boy.
Oh man. It's definitely a step too far. We'll hold off on that one. All right, cool.
All right, man. Much as always. So this is obviously the first of a couplet. What's coming up?
There were some other discussing there, but I think the next one that's related to this that I wanted to maybe talk about was responsibilities and capabilities. So morality and responsibility tend to go together. And I guess that discussion around like, we are capable of all sorts of things as humans. What are the things among those that we have a responsibility for and to cultivate and things like that? So that's kind of where I was looking.
Yeah, I love that one. We'll go into some things that I love pulling into that conversation. Things like reciprocity and community and compassion. Some of these, you know, tingly words that go way back in time that we observed for a long period of time, you know, what kind of works and how that possibly may have led to, you know, what is right and what is good. And then I just slap the whole physical thing on top of that. That'll be good. Look forward to it. Okay, man.
All right.
Take care.
All right. I'll talk to you later.